she said. Young Slavata responded, dazed. But what does she mean? You are confused, Matthew continued sympathetically in Czech. It is common among new ambassadors. Don't worry about it. Tell the queen that Rudolf is delighted to give her this jewel, then we can have dinner. Will you tell her for me? Slavata was completely out of his depth.
I do hope you have not caused another misunderstanding between Emperor Rudolf and me, Master Royden, Elizabeth said, plainly irritated that her command of seven languages didn't extend to Czech.
His Excellency reports that the Emperor wishes your Majesty health and happiness, and Ambassador Slavata is delighted that the necklace is where it belongs and not missing, as the Emperor feared. Matthew looked at his mistress benignly. She started to say something, closed her mouth with a snap, and glared at him. Slavata, eager to learn, wanted to know how Matthew had managed to silence the Queen of England. When the ambassador made a gesture to encourage Matthew to translate, Cecil took the young man in hand.
"Delightful news, Excellency. I think you've had lessons enough for one day. Come dine with me," Cecil said, steering him to a nearby table.
The Queen, upstaged now by both her spy and her chief advisors, harumphed as she climbed the dais, helped up the three low stairs by Bess Throckmorton and Raleigh. "What happens now?" I whispered. The show was over, and the room's occupants were displaying signs of restlessness.
"I will wish to talk further, Master Royden,"
Elizabeth called while her cushions were being arranged to her satisfaction.
"Do not go far."
"Pierre will be in the presence chamber next door. He'll show you to my room, where there's a bed and some peace and quiet. You can rest until Her Majesty frees me. It shouldn't take long. She only wants a full report on Kelly." Matthew brought my hand to his lips and gave it a formal kiss. Knowing Elizabeth's fondness for her male attendants, it could well take hours. Even though I was braced for the clamor of the presence chamber, it knocked me back a step. Courtiers not sufficiently important to warrant dining in the privy chamber jostled me as they passed, eager to get their own dinner before the food was gone. My stomach flipped over at the scent of roasted venison. I would never get used to it, and the baby didn't like it either. Pierre and Annie were standing by the wall with the other servants. They both looked relieved as I came into view.
"Where is Milord?"
Pierre asked, pulling me out of the crush of bodies.
"Waiting on the Queen," I said. "I'm too tired to stand up or eat. Can you take me to Matthew's room?"
Pierre cast a worried look at the entrance to the privy chamber.
"Of course."
"I know the way, Mistress Royden," Annie said. Newly returned from Prague and well into her second visit to the court of Elizabeth, Annie was affecting an attitude of studied nonchalance.
"I showed her Milord's room when you were led away to see Her Majesty," Pierre assured me. "It is just downstairs, below the apartments once used by the king's wife."
"And now used by the queen's favorites, I suppose," I said under my breath. No doubt that's where Walter was sleeping, or not sleeping as the case may be.
"Wait here for Matthew, Pierre. Annie and I can find our way."
"Thank you, madame."
Pierre looked at me gratefully.
"I do not like to leave him too long with the queen."
The members of the queen's staff were tucking into their dinner in the far less splendid surroundings of the guard chamber. They regarded Annie and me with idle curiosity as we walked through.
"There must be a more direct route," I said, biting my lip and looking down the long flight of stairs. The great hall would be even more crowded.
"I'm sorry, mistress, but there isn't," Annie said apologetically.
"Let's face the mob, then," I said with a sigh.
The great hall was thronged with petitioners for the queen's attention. A rustle of excitement greeted my appearance from the direction of the royal apartments, followed by murmurs of disappointment when I proved to be no one of consequence. After Rudolf's court, I was more accustomed to being an object of attention, but it was still uncomfortable to feel the heavy gaze of the humans, the few nudges from demons, the tingling glance of a solitary witch. When the cold stare of a vampire settled on my back, though, I looked around in alarm.
"Mistress?" Annie inquired.
My eyes scanned the crowd, but I was unable to locate the source.
Nothing, Annie, I murmured uneasy. It's just my imagination playing tricks. You're in need of rest, she chided, sounding very like Susanna. But no rest awaited me in Matthew's spacious ground floor rooms overlooking the Queen's private gardens. Instead, I found England's premier playwright. I sent Annie to extract Jack from whatever mess he'd gotten himself into, and steeled myself to face Christopher Marlowe. Hello, Kit, I said. The demon looked up from Matthew's desk, pages of verse scattered around him. All alone?
Walter and Henry are dining with the Queen. Why are you not with them?
Kit looked pale, thin, and distracted. He rose and began to gather his papers, glancing anxiously at the door as though he expected someone to walk in and interrupt us. Too tired, I yawned. But there's no need for you to go. Stay and wait for Matthew. He'll be glad to see you. What are you writing?
A poem.
After this abrupt reply, Kit sat. Something was off. The demon seemed positively twitchy. The tapestry on the wall behind him showed a golden-haired maiden standing in a tower overlooking the sea. She held up a lantern and peered into the distance. That explains it. You're writing about Hero and Leander. It was not phrased as a question. Kit had probably been pining for Matthew and working on the epic love poem since we'd boarded ship at Gravesend back in January. He didn't respond. After a few moments, I recited the relevant lines. Some swore he was a maid in man's attire, for in his looks were all that men desire. A pleasant smiling cheek, a speaking eye, a brow for love to banquet royally. And such as knew he was a man would say, Leander, thou art made for amorous play. Why art thou not in love and loved of all? Kit exploded from his seat.
What witch's mischief is this? You know what I'm doing as soon as I do it.
No mischief, Kit. Who would understand how you feel better than I said carefully. Kit seemed to gather his control, though his hands were shaking as he stood.
I must go. I am to meet someone in the tilt yard. There is talk of a special pageant next month before the Queen sets off for her summer travels. I've been asked to assist.
Every year, Elizabeth progressed around the country with a wagon train of attendants and courtiers, sponging off her nobles and leaving behind enormous debts and empty larders. I'll be sure to tell Matthew you were here. He'll be sorry he missed you. A bright gleam entered Marlowe's eyes.
Perhaps you would like to come with me, Mistress Royden. It is a fine day and you've not seen Greenwich.
Thank you, Kit. I was puzzled by his rapid change of mood, but he was, after all, a demon, and he was mooning over Matthew. Though I'd hoped to rest, and Kit's overtures were stilted, I should make an effort in the interests of harmony. Is it far? I'm somewhat tired after the journey.
Not far at all. Kit bowed. After you.
The tilt yard at Greenwich resembled a grand track and field stadium, with roped-off areas for athletes, stands for spectators, and scattered equipment. Two sets of barricades stretched down the center of the compacted surface. Is that where the jousting takes place? I could imagine the sound of hooves pounding the earth as knights sped toward each other, their lances angled across the necks of their mounts so they could strike their opponent's shield and unseat them.
Yes. Would you like to take a closer look? Kit asked.
The place was deserted. Lances were stuck in the ground here and there. I saw something that looked alarmingly similar to a gibbet, with its upright pole and long arm. Rather than a body, however, a bag of sand swung at the end. It had been run through, and sand trickled out in a thin stream.
A quinton, Marlowe explained, gesturing at the device. Riders aim their lances at the sandbag.
He reached up and gave the arm a push to show me. It swung around, providing a moving target to hone the knight's skill. Marlowe's eyes scanned the tilt yard. Is the man you're meeting here? I looked around, too. But the only person I could see was a tall, dark-haired woman wearing a lavish red dress. She was far in the distance, no doubt having some romantic assignation before dinner. Have you seen the other Quinton?
Kit pointed in the opposite direction, where a mannequin made of straw and rough burlap was tied to a post. This, too, looked more like a form of execution than a piece of sporting equipment. I felt a cold, focused glance. Before I could turn around, a vampire caught me with arms that had the familiar sense of being more steel than flesh. But these arms did not belong to Matthew.
"Why, she is even more delicious than I'd hoped," a woman said, her cold breath snaking around my throat.
Roses. Civet. I registered the scents, tried to remember where I'd smelled the combination before.
Set tour. Louisa de Clermont's room.
"Something in her blood is irresistible to Wes," Kit said roughly. "I do not understand what it is, but even Father Hubbard seems to be in her thrall."
Sharp teeth rasped against my neck, though they did not break the skin.
"It will be amusing to play with her."
"Our plan was to kill her," Kit complained.
He was even twitchier and more restless now that Louisa was here. I remained silent, trying desperately to figure out what game they were playing.
"Then everything will be as it was before."
"Patience." Louisa drank in my scent. "Can you smell her fear? It always sharpens my appetite."
Kit inched closer, fascinated.
"But you are pale, Christopher. Do you need more physic?"
Louisa modified her grasp on me so that she could reach into her purse. She handed Kit a sticky brown lozenge. He took it from her eagerly, thrusting the ball into his mouth.
"They are miraculous, are they not? The Warmbloods in Germany call them stones of immortality, for the ingredients somehow make even pitiful humans feel that they are divine, and they have made you feel strong again."
"It is the witch who weakens me, just as she weakened your brother."
Kit's eyes turned glassy, and there was a sickeningly sweet tang to his breath. Opiates. No wonder he was behaving so strangely.
"Is that true, witch?" "Kit says you bound my brother against his will."
Louisa swung me around. Her beautiful face embodied every Warmblood's nightmare of a vampire. Porcelain pale skin, dusky black hair, and dark eyes that were as fogged with opium as Kit's. Malevolence rolled off her, and her perfectly bowed red lips were not only sensual but cruel. This was a creature who would hunt and kill without a hint of remorse.
"I did not bind your brother. I chose him. And he chose me, Louisa."
"You know who I am?"
Louisa's dark eyebrows rose. "Matthew doesn't keep secrets from me. We're mates. Husband and wife, too. Your father presided over our marriage."
"Thank you, Philippe."
"Liar!"
Louisa screamed. Her pupils engulfed the iris as her control snapped. It wasn't just drugs that I would have to contend with, but blood rage, too.
"Trust nothing, she says," Kit warned.
He pulled a dagger from his doublet and grabbed my hair. I cried out at the pain as he wrenched my head back. Kit's dagger orbited my right eye.
"I am going to pluck out her eyes so that she can no longer use them for enchantments or to see my fate. She knows my death, I am sure of it. Without her witch's sight, she will have no hold on us or on Matthew."
"The witch does not deserve such a swift death," Louisa said bitterly.
Kit pressed the point into my flesh just under the brow bone, and a drop of blood rolled down my cheek.
"That wasn't our agreement, Louisa. To break her spell, I must have her eyes. I want her dead and gone. So long as the witch lives, Matthew will not forget her."
"Shh, Christopher. Do I not love you? Are we not allies?"
Louisa reached for Kit and kissed him deeply. She moved her mouth along his jaw and down to where the blood pounded in his veins. Her lips brushed against the skin, and I saw the smear of blood that accompanied her movement. Kit drew a shuddering breath and closed his eyes. Louisa drank hungrily from the demon's neck. While she did, we stood in a tight knot, locked together in the vampire's strong arms.
I tried to squirm away, but her grip on me only tightened as her teeth and lips battened on Kit. "Sweet Christopher," she murmured when she had drunk her fill, licking at the wound. The mark on Kit's neck was silvery and soft, just like the scar on my breast.
Louisa must have fed from him before.
"I can taste the immortality in your blood and see the beautiful words that dance through your thoughts. Matthew is a fool not to want to share them with you."
"He wants only the witch."
Kit touched his neck, imagining that it was Matthew and not his sister who had drunk from his veins.
"I want her dead."
"As do I." Louisa turned her bottomless black eyes on me. "And so we will compete for her. Whoever wins may do with her as she, or he, will, to make her atone for the wrong she has done my brother. Do you agree, my darling boy?"
The two of them were high as kites now that Louisa had shared Kit's opiate-laden blood. I started to panic, then recalled Philippe's instructions at Settur. "Think. Stay alive." Then I remembered the baby, and my panic returned. I couldn't endanger our child. Kit nodded. "I will do anything to have Matthew's regard once more."
"I thought so." Louisa smiled and kissed him deeply again. "Shall we choose our colors?"
Chapter 35.
"You are making a terrible mistake, Louisa," I warned, struggling against my bonds. She and Kit had removed the shapeless straw and burlap mannequin and tied me to the post in its place. Then Kit had blindfolded me with a strip of dark blue silk taken from the tip of one of the waiting lances so that I couldn't enchant them with my gaze. The two stood nearby, arguing over who would use the black and silver lance and who the green and gold.
"You'll find Matthew with the queen. He'll explain everything."
I tried to keep my voice steady, but it trembled. Matthew had told me about his sister in modern Oxford while we drank tea by his fireplace at the old lodge. She was as vicious as she was beautiful.
"You dare to utter his name?"
Kit was wild with anger.
"Do not speak again, witch, or I will let Christopher remove your tongue after all."
Louisa's voice was venomous, and I didn't need to see her eyes to know that poppy and blood rage were not a good mix. The point of Isabeau's diamond scratched lightly against my cheek, drawing blood. Louisa had broken my finger wrenching it off and was now wearing it herself.
"I am Matthew's wife, his mate. What do you imagine his reaction will be when he finds out what you've done?" "You are a monster, a beast. If I win the challenge, I will strip you of your false humanity and expose what lies underneath."
Louisa's words trickled into my ears like poison.
"Once I have, Matthew will see what you truly are, and he will share in our pleasure at your death." When their conversation faded into the distance, I had no way of knowing where they were or from which direction they might return. I was utterly alone.
"Think. Stay alive." Something fluttered in my chest, but it wasn't panic, it was my fire drake. I wasn't alone, and I was a witch. I didn't need my eyes to see the world around me.
"What do you see?" I asked the earth and the air.
It was my fire drake who answered. She chirped and chattered, her wings stirring in the space between my belly and lungs as she assessed the situation.
"Where are they?" I wondered.
My third eye opened wide, revealing the shimmering colors of late spring in all their blue and green glory. One darker green thread was twisted with white and tangled with something black. I followed it to Louisa, who was climbing onto the back of an agitated horse. It wouldn't stand still for the vampire and kept shying away. Louisa bit it on the neck, which made the horse stand stock still but did nothing to alleviate its terror. I followed another set of threads, these crimson and white, thinking they might lead to Matthew. Instead, I saw a bewildering whirl of shapes and colors. I fell. Far.
far until I landed on a cold pillow. Snow. I drew the cold winter air into my lungs. I was no longer tied to a stake on a late May afternoon at Greenwich Palace. I was 4 or 5, lying on my back in the small yard behind our house in Cambridge. And I remembered. My father and I had been playing after a heavy snowfall. My mittens were Harvard crimson against the white. We were making angels, our arms and legs sweeping up and down. I was fascinated by how, if I moved my arms quickly enough, the white wings seemed to take on a red tinge.
"It's like the dragon with the fiery wings," I whispered to my father.
His arms stilled.
"When did you see a dragon, Diana?"
His voice was serious. I knew the difference between that tone and his usual teasing one. It meant he expected an answer, and a truthful one.
"Lots of times? Mostly at night."
My arms beat faster and faster. The snow underneath their span was changing color, shimmering with green and gold, red and black, silver and blue.
"And where was it?" he whispered, staring at the snowdrifts.
They were mounting up around me, heaving and rumbling as though alive. One grew tall and stretched itself into a slender dragon's head. The drift stretched wide into a pair of wings. The dragon shook flakes of snow from its white scales. When it turned and looked at my father, he murmured something and patted its nose as though he and the dragon had already met. The dragon breathed warm vapor into the frigid air.
"Mostly it's inside me. Here."
I sat up to show my father what I meant. My mittened hands went to the curved bones of my ribs. They were warm through the skin, through my jacket, through the chunky knit of the mittens.
"But when she needs to fly, I have to let her out. There's not enough room for her wings otherwise."
A pair of shining wings rested on the snow behind me.
"You left your own wings behind," my father said gravely.
The dragon wormed her way out of the snowdrift. Her silver and black eyes blinked as she pulled free, rose into the air and disappeared over the apple tree, becoming more insubstantial with every flap of her wings. Mine were already fading on the snow behind me.
"The dragon won't take me with her, and she never stays around for very long," I said with a sigh. "Why is that, Daddy?"
"Maybe she has somewhere else to be."
I considered this possibility.
"Like when you and Mommy go to school?"
It was perplexing to think of parents going to school. All the children on the block thought so, even though most of their parents spent all day at school too.
"Just like that."
My father was still sitting in the snow, his arms wrapped around his knees. He smiled.
"I love the witch in you, Diana."
"She scares Mommy."
"Nah." My father shook his head. "Mommy is just scared of change."
"I tried to keep the dragon a secret, but I think she knows anyway," I said glumly.
"Mommies usually do," my father said.
He looked down at the snow. My wings were entirely gone now.
"But she knows when you want hot chocolate, too. If we go inside, my guess is she'll have it ready."
My father got to his feet and held out his hand. I slipped mine, still wearing crimson mittens, into his warm grip.
"Will you always be here to hold my hand when it gets dark?" I asked.
Night was falling, and I was suddenly afraid of the shadows. Monsters lurked in the gloom, strange creatures who watched me as I played.
"Nope," my father said with a shake of his head.
My lip trembled. That wasn't the answer I wanted.
"But don't worry."
His voice dropped to a whisper.
"You'll always have your dragon."
A drop of blood fell from the pierced skin around my eye to the ground by my feet. Even though I was blindfolded, I could see its leisurely movement and the way it landed with a wet splat. A black shoot emerged from the spot. Hooves thundered toward me. Someone gave a high, keening cry that conjured up images of ancient battles. The sound made the fire drake even more restless. I needed to free myself, fast. Instead of trying to see the threads that led to Kit and Louisa, I focused on the ones wrapped in the fibers that bound my wrists and ankles. I was starting to make progress loosening them when something sharp and heavy splintered against my ribs. The impact knocked the breath from my body.
"A hit!" Kit cried. "The witch is mine!"
"A glancing blow," Louisa corrected. "You must seat the lance in her body to claim her as your prize."
Sadly, I didn't know the rules, neither of jousting nor of magic either. Goody Alsop had made that plain before we left for Prague.
"All you have now is a wayward fire drake, a glam that is near to blinding, and a tendency to ask questions that have mischievous answers," she'd said.
I'd been neglecting my weaving in favor of court intrigue, and stopped pursuing my magic to hunt for Ashmole 782. Perhaps if I'd stayed in London, I would have known how to get myself out of this mess. Instead, I was bound to a thick log like a witch about to be set alight.
Think. Stay alive.
"We must try again," Louisa said.
Her words faded as she wheeled her horse around and rode away.
"Don't do this, Kit," I said. "Think what it will do to Matthew. If you want me gone, I'll go, I promise."
"Your promises are nothing, witch. You will cross your fingers and find a way to wriggle out of your assurances.
I can see the glam about you even now as you try to work your magic against me."
A glam near to blinding, questions that elicit mischievous answers, and a wayward fire drake. Everything went still.
"What should we do?" I asked the fire drake.
Her response was to snap her wings, extending them fully. They slid between my ribs, through the flesh, and emerged on either side of my spine. The fire drake stayed where she was, her tail wrapped protectively around my womb. She peeked out from behind my sternum, her silver and black eyes bright, and flapped her wings again.
"Stay alive," she whispered in reply, her words sending a pall of gray mist into the air around me.
The force of her wings snapped the thick wooden pole at my back, and the barbs on their scalloped edges sliced through the rope that bound my wrists. Something sharp and claw-like cut through the bindings around my ankles, too. I rose 20 feet up into the air as Kit and Louisa entered the fire drake's disorienting gray cloud. They were moving too quickly to stop or change direction. Their lances crossed, tangled, and the force of the clash sent them both flying from their saddles onto the hard earth below. I ripped the blindfold from my eyes with my undamaged hand just as Annie appeared at the edge of the tilt yard.
"Mistress?"
she cried. But I didn't want her here, not around Louisa de Clermont.
"Go,"
I hissed. My words emerged in fire and smoke as I circled above Kit and Louisa. Blood trickled from my wrists and feet. Wherever the red beads fell, a black shoot grew. Soon a palisade of slender black trunks surrounded the dazed demon and vampire. Louisa tried to pull them from the ground, but my magic held.
"Shall I tell you your futures?" I asked harshly.
Both stared up at me from their pen with avid, fearful eyes. "You will never get your heart's desire, Kit, because sometimes what we want most we cannot have. And you will never fill the hollow places inside you, Louisa, neither with blood nor with anger. And both of you will die, because death comes for all of us sooner or later. But your deaths will not be gentle, I promise you that."
A whirlwind approached. It stilled, became recognizable as Hancock.
"Davy!"
Louisa's pearly fingers gripped the black stakes that surrounded her.
"Help us! The witch used her magic to bring us down. Take her eyes, and you will take her power, too."
"Matthew is already on his way, Louisa," Hancock answered. "You are safer in that stockade under Diana's protection than you would be running from his anger."
"None of us is safe. She will fulfill the ancient prophecy, the one that Gerbert shared with Mama all those years ago. She will bring down the de Clermonts."
"There's no truth in it," Hancock said with pity.
"There is," Louisa insisted. "Beware the witch with the blood of the lion and the wolf, for with it she shall destroy the children of the night. This is the witch of the prophecy, don't you see?"
"You are not well, Louisa. I can see that plainly."
Louisa drew herself up indignant.
I am a Manja Song and in perfect health, Hancock.
Henry and Jack arrived next, their sides heaving with exertion. Henry scanned the tilt yard.
Where is she?
He shouted at Hancock, spinning around.
Up there,
Hancock said, jerking his thumb in the air.
Just like Annie said.
Diana.
Henry sighed with relief. A dark cyclone of gray and black whipped across the tilt yard and came to a rest at a broken stake that marked the spot where I had been bound. Matthew needed no one to tell him where I was now. His eyes unerringly found me. Walter and Pierre were the last to arrive. Pierre was carrying Annie piggyback, her thin arms wrapped tight around his neck. When he stopped, she slid from his back.
Walter!
Kit cried, joining Louisa at the barrier.
She must be stopped. Let us out. I know what to do now. I spoke with the witch in Newgate and...
An arm punched through the black railings, and long white fingers grabbed Kit around the throat. Marlowe gurgled to silence.
Not one word.
Matthew's eyes swept over Louisa.
Mathieu!
Blood and drugs further slurred Louisa's French pronunciation of his name.
Thank God you are here. I'm glad to see you.
You shouldn't be.
Matthew flung Kit away. I lowered down behind him, the newly sprouted wings withdrawing back inside my ribs. My firedrake remained alert, however, her tail tightly coiled. Matthew sensed me there and hooked me into his arm, though he never took his eyes off my captives. His fingers brushed against the spot where the lance had gone through bodice, corset, and skin, only to be stopped by the bony cage of my ribs. It was damp where the blood had soaked through. Matthew spun around and fell to his knees, tearing the fabric from the wound. He swore. One hand settled on my abdomen, and his eyes searched mine.
I'm fine.
We're fine, I assured him. He stood, his eyes black and the vein in his temple throbbing.
Master Royden?
Jack sidled closer to Matthew. His chin was trembling. Matthew's hand shot out and grabbed him by the collar, stopping him before he could get too close to me. Jack didn't flinch.
Are you having a nightmare?
Matthew's hand dropped, releasing the boy.
Yes, Jack. A terrible nightmare.
Jack slid his hand into Matthew's.
I will wait by your side until it passes.
My eyes pricked with tears. It was what Matthew said to him deep in the night, when Jack's terrors threatened to engulf him. Matthew's hand tightened on Jack's in silent acknowledgement. The two of them stood, one tall and broad and filled with preternatural health, the other slight and awkward and only now shedding the shadows of neglect. Matthew's rage began to ebb.
When Annie told me a female werch had you, I never imagined.
He couldn't continue.
It was Christopher,
Louisa cried, distancing herself from the wild demon at her side.
He said you were enchanted. But I can smell her blood on you. You are not under her spell, but feeding from her.
She is my mate, Matthew explained, his tone deadly. And she is with child.
Marlowe's breath came out in a hiss. His eyes nudged my belly. My broken hand moved to protect our child from the demon's gaze.
"'Tis impossible. Matthew cannot."
Kit's confusion turned to fury.
"'Even now she has bewitched him. How could you betray him thus? Who fathered your child, Mistress Royden?"
Mary Sidney had assumed I'd been raped. Galloglass had first attributed the baby to a deceased lover or husband, either of which would have roused Matthew's protective instincts and explained our swift romance. For Kit, the only possible answer was that I had cuckolded the man he loved.
"'Take her, Hancock,' Louisa begged. "'We cannot allow a witch to introduce her bastard into the de Clermont family.'
Hancock shook his head at Louisa and crossed his arms.
"'You tried to run my mate down. You drew her blood,' Matthew said. "'And the child is no bastard. It's mine.'
It is not possible, Louisa said, but she sounded uncertain.
The child is mine, her brother repeated fiercely. My flesh, my blood.
She carries the blood of the wolf, Louisa whispered. The witch is the one the prophecy foretold. If the baby lives, it will destroy us all.
Get them out of my sight.
Matthew's voice was dead with rage. Before I tear them into pieces and feed them to the dogs. He kicked down the palisade and grabbed his friend and his sister.
I'm not going,
Louisa began. She looked down to find Hancock's hand wrapped around her arm.
Oh, you'll go where I take you, he said softly.
Hancock worked Isabeau's ring from her finger and tossed it to Matthew.
I believe that belongs to your wife.
And Kit? Walter asked, eyeing Matthew warily.
As they're so fond of each other, lock him up with Louisa.
Matthew thrust the demon at Raleigh.
But she'll, Walter began, feed on him?
Matthew looked sour. She has already. The only way a vampire feels the effects of wine or physic is from a warm blood's vein.
Walter gauged Matthew's mood and nodded.
Very well, Matthew. We will follow your wishes. Take Diana and the children to the Blackfriars. Leave everything else to Hancock and me.
I told him there was nothing to worry about. The baby is fine. I lowered my smock. We'd come straight home, but Matthew had sent Pierre to fetch Susanna and Goody Allsup anyway. Now the house was full to bursting with angry vampires and witches. Maybe you can convince him of it. Susanna rinsed her hands in the basin of hot, soapy water.
If your husband will not believe his own eyes, nothing I can do or say will persuade him.
She called for Matthew. Galloglass came with him, the two of them filling the doorway.
Are you all right, in truth?
Galloglass's face was ashen. I had a broken finger and a cracked rib. I could have gotten them falling on the stairs. Thanks to Susanna, my finger is completely healed. I stretched my hand. It was still swollen, and I had to wear Isabeau's ring on my other hand, but I could move the fingers without pain. The gash in my side would take more time. Matthew had refused to use vampire blood to heal it, so Susanna had resorted to a few magical stitches and a poultice instead.
There are many good reasons to hate Louisa at this moment, Matthew said grimly. But here is something to be thankful for. She did not wish to kill you. Louisa's aim is impeccable. Had she wanted to put her lance through your heart, you would be dead.
Louisa was too preoccupied with the prophecy that Gerbert shared with Isabeau. Galloglass and Matthew exchanged looks.
It's nothing, Matthew said dismissively. Just some idiotic thing he dreamed up to excite Maman.
It was Meridiana's prophecy, wasn't it? I had known it in my bones ever since Louisa mentioned it. The words brought back memories of Gerbert's touch at La Pierre, and they had made the air around Louisa snap with electricity, as though she were Pandora and had taken the lid off a trove of long-forgotten magic.
Meridiana wanted to frighten Gerbert about the future. She did.
Matthew shook his head.
It's got nothing to do with you.
Your father is the lion. You are the wolf. Ice pooled in the pit of my stomach. It told me something was wrong with me, inside where the light could never quite reach. I looked at my husband, one of the children of the night mentioned in the prophecy. Our first child had already died. I shuddered my thoughts, not wanting to hold them in my heart or my head long enough to make an impression. But it did no good. There was too much honesty between us now to hide from Matthew, or myself.
You have nothing to fear, Matthew said, brushing his lips over mine. You are too full of life to be a harbinger of destruction.
I let him reassure me, but my sixth sense ignored him. Somehow, somewhere, a dangerous and deadly force had been unleashed. Even now I could feel its threads tightening, drawing me toward the darkness. Chapter 36. I was waiting under the sign of the Golden Gosling for Annie to pick up some stew for tonight's supper when the steady regard of a vampire drove the hint of summer from the air. "Father Hubbard," I said, turning in the direction of the coldness. The vampire's eyes flickered over my ribcage.
"I am surprised your husband allows you to walk about the city unaccompanied, given what happened at Greenwich, and that you're carrying his child."
My fire drake, who had become fiercely protective since the incident in the tilt yard, coiled her tail around my hips. "Everyone knows that Huerchs can't father children on warm-blooded women," I said dismissively.
"It seems that the impossible holds little sway with a witch such as you."
Hubbard's grim countenance tightened further.
"Most creatures believe that Matthew's contempt for witches is unchangeable, for example. Few would entertain the notion that it was he who made it possible for Barbara Napier to escape the pyre in Scotland."
The events in Barrett continued to occupy Matthew's time, as well as creature and human gossip in London. Matthew was nowhere near Scotland at the time.
He didn't need to be. Hancock was in Edinburgh, posing as one of Napier's friends. It was he who brought the matter of her pregnancy to the court's attention.
Hubbard's breath was cold and smelled of the forest. "The witch was innocent of the charges against her," I said brusquely, drawing my shawl around my shoulders. "The jury acquitted her."
"Of a single charge."
Hubbard held my gaze.
"She was found guilty of many more. And given your recent return, perhaps you have not heard. King James found a way to reverse the jury's decision in Napier's case."
"Reverse it? How?"
"The King of Scots is not greatly enamored of the congregation these days, no small thanks to your husband. Matthew's slippery sense of the Covenant and his interference in Scottish politics have inspired His Majesty to find his own legal loopholes. James is putting the jurors who acquitted the witch on trial. They're charged with miscarrying the King's justice. Intimidating the jurors will better ensure the outcome of future trials."
"That wasn't Matthew's plan," I said, my mind reeling.
"It sounds sufficiently devious for Matthew de Clermont. Napier and her babe may live, but dozens more innocent creatures will die because of it."
Hubbard's expression was deadly.
"Isn't that what the de Clermonts want?"
"How dare you? I have the..." Annie stepped out onto the street and nearly dropped her pot. I reached out and hooked her into my arm. "Thank you, Annie."
"Do you know where your husband is this fine May morning, Mistress Royden?"
"He is out on business." Matthew had made sure I ate my breakfast, kissed me, and left the house with Pierre. Jack had been inconsolable when Matthew told him he must stay behind with Harriet. I felt a flicker of unease. It wasn't like Matthew to refuse Jack a trip into town.
"No," Hubbard said softly. "He is in Bedlam with his sister and Christopher Marlowe."
Bedlam was an oubliette in all but name. A place for forgetting, where the insane were locked up with those interred by their own families on some trumped-up charge, simply to be rid of them. With nothing but straw for bedding, no regular supply of food, not a shred of kindness from the jailers, and no treatment of any sort. Most inmates never escaped. If they did, they rarely recovered from the experience.
"Not content with altering the judgment in Scotland, Matthew now seeks to mete out his own justice here in London," Hubbard continued. "He went to question them this morning. I understand he's still there."
It was past noon.
"I have seen Matthew de Clermont kill quickly when he is enraged. It is terrible to behold. To see him do so slowly, painstakingly, would make the most resolute atheist believe in the devil."
"Kit." Louisa was a vampire and shared Isabeau's blood. She could fend for herself, but a demon? "Go to Goody Alsop, Annie. Tell her I've gone to Bedlam to look after Master Marlowe and Master Royden's sister." I turned the girl in the proper direction and released her, putting my own body squarely between her and the vampire.
"I must stay with you," Annie said, her eyes huge. "Master Royden made me promise."
"Someone must know where I've gone, Annie. Tell Goody Alsop what you heard here. I can find my way to Bedlam." In truth, I had only a vague notion of the notorious asylum's location, but I had other means of discovering Matthew's whereabouts. I wrapped imaginary fingers around the chain within me and got ready to pull it.
Wait.
Hubbard's hand closed around my wrist. I jumped. He called to someone in the shadows. It was the angular young man Matthew referred to by the strangely fitting name Amen Corner.
My son will take you.
Matthew will know I've been with you now. I looked down at Hubbard's hand. It was still wrapped around my wrist, transferring his telltale scent to my warm skin. He'll take it out on the boy. Hubbard's grip tightened, and I let out a soft sound of understanding.
If you wanted to accompany me to Bedlam as well, Father Hubbard, all you needed to do was ask.
Hubbard knew every shortcut and back alley between St. James Garlickhithe and Bishopsgate. We passed beyond the city limits and into one of London's squalid suburbs. Like Cripplegate, the area around Bedlam was poverty-stricken and desperately crowded. But the true horrors were yet to come.
The keeper met us at the gate and led us into what had once been known as the Hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem.
Master Sleaford was well acquainted with Father Hubbard and could not bow and scrape enough as he led us to one of the stout doors across the pitted courtyard. Even with the thick wood and stone of the old medieval priory between us, the inmates' screams were piercing. Most of the windows were unglazed and open to the elements. The stench of rot, filth, and age was overwhelming.
"Don't," I said, refusing Hubbard's proffered hand as we entered the dank, close confines.
There was something obscene about taking his help when I was free and the inmates were offered no assistance at all. Inside, I was bombarded by the ghosts of past inmates and the jagged threads that twisted around the hospital's current, tormented inhabitants. I dealt with the horror by engaging in macabre mathematical exercises, dividing the men and women I saw into smaller groups only to lump them together in a new way. I counted 20 inmates during our walk down the corridor. 14 were demons. A half dozen of the 20 were completely unclothed, and 10 more were dressed only in rags. A woman wearing a filthy, though expensive, man's suit stared at us with open hostility. She was one of the 3 humans in the place. There were 2 witches and 1 vampire as well. 15 of the poor souls were manacled to the wall, chained to the floor, or both. 4 of the other 5 were unable to stand and crouched by the walls, chattering and scraping at the stone. 1 of the patients was free. He danced, naked, down the corridor ahead of us. 1 room had a door. Something told me that Louisa and Kit were behind it. The keeper unlocked the door and knocked sharply. When he didn't get an immediate response, he pounded.
"I heard you the first time, Master Sleaford."
Gallowglass looked decidedly worse for wear, with fresh scratches down his cheek and blood on his doublet. When he saw me standing behind Sleaford, he did a double take.
"Auntie."
"Let me in."
"That's not such a good..."
Gallowglass took another look at my expression and stepped aside.
"Louisa's lost a fair bit of blood. She's hungry. Stay away from her, unless you're of a mind to be bitten or clawed. I've trimmed her nails, but there's not much I can do about her teeth."
Although nothing stood in my way, I remained rooted to the threshold. The beautiful, cruel Louisa was chained to an iron ring set into the stone floor. Her dress was in tatters, and blood from deep gashes in her neck covered her. Someone had been asserting his dominance over Louisa, someone stronger and angrier than she was. I searched the shadows until I found a dark figure crouched over a lump on the floor. Matthew's head swung up, his face ghostly pale and his eyes black as night. Not a speck of blood was on him. Like Hubbard's offer of help, his cleanliness was somehow obscene.
"You should be at home, Diana."
Matthew stood.
"I am exactly where I need to be, thank you."
I moved in my husband's direction. "Blood rage and poppy don't mix, Matthew. How much of their blood have you taken?"
The lump on the floor stirred.
"I am here, Christopher," Hubbard called. "You will come to no more harm."
Marlowe wept with relief, his body racked with sobs.
"Bedlam isn't in London, Hubbard," Matthew said coldly. "You're out of your bailiwick, and Kit is beyond your protection." Christ, here we go again.
Galloglass closed the door in Sleaford's stunned face.
Lock it, he barked through the wood, punctuating his command with the thud of his fist.
Louisa sprang to her feet when the metal mechanism ground shut, the chains rattling around her ankles and wrists. One of them snapped, and I jumped as the broken links chimed against the floor. A sympathetic banging of chains sounded along the corridor.
Not my blood, not my blood, not my blood, Louisa chanted.
She was as flat as possible against the far wall. When I met her eyes, she whimpered and turned away.
Be gone, Phantom. I have already died once and have nothing to fear from ghosts like you.
Be quiet.
Matthew's voice was low, but it cracked through the room with enough force that we all jumped.
Thirsty, Louisa croaked. Please, Matthew.
There was a regular splat of wetness against stone. With each splash, Louisa's body jerked. Someone had suspended a stag's head by the antlers, its eyes empty and staring. Blood fell, one drop at a time, from its severed neck and onto the floor, just beyond the reach of Louisa's chains.
Stop torturing her!
I stepped forward, but Galloglass's hand held me back.
I can't let you interfere, Auntie, he said firmly. Matthew's right, you don't belong in the middle of this. Galloglass.
Matthew shook his head in warning. Galloglass released my arm and watched his uncle warily.
Very well, then. Let me answer your earlier question, Auntie. Matthew has had just enough of Kit's blood to keep his blood rage burning. You may need this if you want to talk to him.
Galloglass tossed me a knife. I made no move to catch it, and the blade clattered to the stones.
You are more than this disease, Matthew.
I stepped over the blade and made my way to his side. We stood so close that my skirts brushed against his boots.
Let Father Hubbard see to Kit.
No.
Matthew's expression was unyielding.
What would Jack think if he saw you this way?
I was willing to use guilt rather than steel to bring Matthew to his senses.
You're his hero.
Heroes do not torment their friends or family.
They tried to kill you.
Matthew's roar reverberated through the small room.
They were out of their minds with opiates and alcohol. Neither of them knew what they were doing, I retorted. Nor, may I add, do you in your present state.
Don't fool yourself. Both of them knew exactly what they were doing. Kit was ridding himself of an obstacle to his happiness without a care for anyone else. Louisa was succumbing to the same cruel urges she's indulged since the day she was made.
Matthew ran his fingers through his hair.
I know what I'm doing, too.
Yes, you're punishing yourself. You are convinced that biology is destiny, at least so far as your own blood rage is concerned.
As a result, you think you're just like Louisa and Kit, just another madman. I asked you to stop denying your instincts, Matthew, not to become a slave to them.
This time, when I took a step toward Matthew's sister, she sprang at me, spitting and snarling.
And there's your greatest fear for the future. That you'll be reduced to an animal, chained up and waiting for the next punishment because it's what you deserve.
I went back to him, gripping his shoulders.
You are not this man, Matthew. You never were.
I've told you before not to romanticize me, he said shortly.
He dragged his eyes away from mine, but not before I'd seen the desperation there.
So this is for my benefit, too? You're still trying to prove that you're not worth loving?
His hands were clenched at his sides. I reached for them and forced them open, pulling them flat against my belly.
Hold our child. Look me in the eye and tell us that there's no hope for a different ending to this story.
As on the night I'd waited for him to take my vein, time stretched out to infinity while Matthew wrestled with himself. Now, as then, I could do nothing to speed the process or help him choose life over death. He had to grab Hope's fragile thread without any help from me.
I don't know, he finally admitted. Once I knew that love between a vampire and a witch was wrong. I was sure the four species were distinct. I accepted the deaths of witches if it meant that vampires and demons survived.
Though his pupils still eclipsed his eyes, a bright sliver of green appeared.
I told myself that the madness among demons and the weaknesses among vampires were relatively recent developments, but now that I see Louisa and Kit...
You don't know.
I lowered my voice. None of us do.
It's a frightening prospect, but we have to hope in the future, Matthew. I don't want our children to be born under this same shadow, hating and fearing who they are.
I waited for him to fight me further, but he remained silent. Let Galloglass take responsibility for your sister. Allow Hubbard to tend to Kit. And try to forgive them.
Quacks do not forgive as easily as warmbloods do, Galloglass said gruffly. You cannot ask that of him.
Matthew asked it of you, I pointed out.
Aye, and I told him the best he could hope for was that I might, in time, forget. Don't demand more from Matthew than he can give, Auntie. He is his own worst rackmaster, and he needs no assistance from you.
Galloglass's voice held a warning.
I would like to forget, witch,
Louisa said primly, as if she were making a simple choice of fabric for a new gown. She waved her hand in the air.
All of this. Use your magic and make these horrible dreams go away.
It was in my power to do it. I could see the threads binding her to Bedlam, to Matthew, and to me. But though I didn't want to torture Louisa, I was not so forgiving as to grant her peace.
No, Louisa, I said. You will remember Greenwich for the rest of your days, and me, and even how you hurt Matthew. Let that be your prison, and not this place.
I turned to Galloglass. Make sure she isn't a danger to herself or anyone else before you set her free.
Oh, she won't enjoy any freedom, Galloglass promised. She'll go from here to wherever Philippe sends her. After what she's done, my grandfather will never let her roam again.
Tell them, Matthew, Louisa pleaded. You understand what it is to have these things crawling in your skull. I cannot bear them.
She pulled at her hair with a manacled hand.
And Kit? Galloglass asked. You are sure you want him in Hubbard's custody, Matthew? I know that Hancock would be delighted to dispatch him.
He is Hubbard's creature, not mine. Matthew's tone was absolute. I care not what happens to him.
What I did was out of love, Kit began.
You did it out of spite, Matthew said, turning his back on his best friend.
Father Hubbard, I called as he rushed to collect his charge. Kit's actions at Greenwich will be forgotten, provided that what happened here stays within these walls.
You promise this on behalf of all the de Clermonts?
Hubbard's pale eyebrows lifted.
Your husband must give me this assurance, not you.
My word is going to have to be enough, I said, standing my ground.
Very well, Madame de Clermont.
It was the first time that Hubbard had used my title.
You are indeed Philippe's daughter. I accept your family's terms.
Even after we left Bedlam, I could feel its darkness clinging to us. Matthew did too. It followed us everywhere we went in London, accompanied us to dinner, visited with our friends. There was only one way to rid ourselves of it. We had to return to our present. Without discussion or conscious plans, we both began putting our affairs in order, snipping the threads that bound us to the past we now shared. Francoise had been planning to rejoin us in London, but we sent word for her to remain at the old lodge. Matthew had long and complicated conversations with Galloglass about the lies his nephew would have to tell, so as not to reveal to the 16th century Matthew that he'd been temporarily replaced by his future self. The 16th century Matthew could not be allowed to see Kit or Louisa, for neither could be trusted. Walter and Henry would make up some story to explain any discontinuities in behavior. Matthew sent Hancock to Scotland to prepare for a new life there. I worked with Goody Alsop, perfecting the knots I would use to weave the spell that would carry us into the future. Matthew met me in St. James Garlickhithe after one of my lessons and suggested we stroll through St. Paul's Churchyard on our way home. It was 2 weeks from midsummer, and the days were sunny and bright in spite of Bedlam's persistent pall. Though Matthew still looked drawn after his experience with Louisa and Kit, It felt almost like old times when we stopped at the booksellers to see the latest titles and news. I was reading a fresh volley in the war of words between two spatting Cambridge graduates when Matthew stiffened.